I'm Jim Perlstein, and I'm interviewing Jerry Myers as part of the history of the PSC. And since this is a history of the union through biography, why don't we start at the beginning? Where were you born?
I was born in Hoboken, New Jersey, and I was the middle son of three boys, and I don't know if my parents, my mother had been born in Hoboken and lived there. My father had lived in the next town up from there, Union City, New Jersey, and this is all within Hudson County, New Jersey, right across the river. And so I don't know. I forgot to ask them, had they lived there after I was born, or where exactly they lived after I was born. But my first memories were, which I think might have been when I was 2.5 or 3, were we lived in West New York, New Jersey, which is in a kind of an adjoining town. And we lived in a three-room tenement. And there was no central heating. There was only a coal stove in the kitchen. And it's hard to imagine that a little bit, but in a town like West New York, or other towns in Hudson County, Hoboken and so on, there weren't the housing codes that existed that LaGuardia had put in place, for example, in New York. So there was a coal stove, and there was no hot water. So there was a kind of tank in the kitchen to make hot water with gas. And there was gas on the stove to cook, but the heating actually came from starting a fire with coal in the kitchen. My grandmother, I visited the house recently, outside at least, and it was a four-story house, and there were four families on each floor. And we were on the second floor, back left, and my grandmother was on the first floor with my grandfather on the first floor on the right front. And my mother didn't know how to make a fire to make this happen, you know, the heat for the house and so on, and my grandmother would take care of that. And but we were very poor. There were tubs in the kitchen to do the wash, and they were like made of concrete, and we would bathe there. And later, I think what I realized is I think the bathroom was too cold. There was no heat, so we couldn't use. There was a bathtub, but I think that's why we were bathed in these wash tubs that were made like of concrete. There was no porcelain. And my father at the time worked in the shipyards in Hoboken. It was during the war, and as a welder. And I think he was really happy. You know, I think we were poor, but he worked. He worked a lot of overtime, and I think he liked what he was doing. You know, and my mother was a housewife, but my grandmother seemed to do most of the work. She was always around taking care of us and cooking or doing something, or taking us to the park. But it was starkly poor looking back. I remember one of my earliest memories was that the landlord arrived with a big paper bag. Well, I believe there might have been two. And he said, "Do you want these?" And we were sitting at the kitchen table, my grandmother and the three boys. And my grandmother said yes, and what it was toys. It was various kinds of toys, kind of old-fashioned toys. And those were our first toys that the landlord brought, you know.
Let me ask you a question. A lot of people remember the years of World War II as the heyday of factory work in America.
Yes.
When, you know, a factory job was a good job, you could support a family easily, you could see yourself rising out of the working class even, but that apparently did not happen.
Well, there were wage controls. So I don't think, and my mother didn't work, you know, there were three children, and we were all young. I had a brother 2.5 years older and a brother 1.5 years younger. We might have been, came into existence in part to keep my father out of the war. I think he might have been a little bit older at that time, too. And I think my mother was very interested in that. I think he was happy, but there were no signs of any prosperity whatsoever. Mm-hmm. He was starkly poor. I can remember it very distinctly to this day, everything about it. One of my earliest memories was collecting wood in the street with my grandmother for the stove. I mean, we were really poor. We would go to the park, and my grandmother would take a tablespoon, and we would dig in the dirt with this tablespoon. I was just sort of all kind of very odd, you know, and she'd be darning socks, you know, things that seem very peculiar by today's standards. Somehow we were happy. I don't know, there was something there. There was no memory of anything unhappy particularly there. My father was an air raid warden, and that was kind of exciting. You know, there would be air raid drills, and there were these, you know, green shades that would come down, and my father would go with his flashlight out on the street, and we thought he was some kind of hero, and, you know, that was kind of nice. But somehow, my feelings at that time were not negative at all, particularly as a child, you know.
Was there a wide family network that you were part of in that part of New Jersey?
Well, the fact that my grandmother was downstairs was very critical. I mean, she was always there in the house. And I know, like, she would send me and my older brother out into the backyard to steal clothespins. Everybody had wash lines. And she would take the clothespins, take the and things like that. She was, like, very earthy, my grandmother. She was also Jewish, but we don't want to get too much into all this ethnic stuff. But anyway, but she was very earthy. And my mother, but kind of like down to earth, like getting things done somehow, like stealing clothes. If you get something done. And my mother was a bit out of it, I think. She was kind of like, she couldn't quite figure out what to do or whatever. And I remember we would take the firewood and put it in the bathtub, and we use it as boats. You know, so the memories weren't too bad, but we were, you know, people sat outside the women sat outside on chairs, folding chairs.
Aside from family, did your family have a lot of friends in the neighborhood?
Well,
was there a lot of an active social life?
There was some help from an involvement with my grandmother's sisters who lived in the neighborhood. That was the Jewish connection. And they brought things for us, like, you know, toys and so on, I remember. Some of them were, like, because my one aunt had two daughters, and she'd bring toys that were clearly were meant for girls. But anyway, there were three boys in my family. But I remember that. There was a little bit of contact with my mother's sister, but not a lot. I think my parents were very ashamed of being poor, and they therefore isolated a lot. So there wasn't a lot of hospitality offered. My father had an old bachelor uncle who had no place to go on holidays, and he would join us, Uncle Otto. But I do think when I look back at it, we weren't allowed to have kids in the house, and there wasn't company. You know, we stayed more by ourselves. But I think it happened because I think they were really ashamed at how poor we were. But there was also some type of disorganization in the household.
Was the family, as you were growing up, religious at all?
My mother was fanatically religious as a Catholic, and, you know, very absorbed with that. And so her idea of what to do was to take us to church a lot, you know, and particularly me. I think the focus was more on me. And there were a lot of religious, icons in the house, you know, pictures and so on. I mean, that was very evident. My father stayed apart from that. He didn't participate much.
That didn't create any conflict.
I don't think so. And later he joined her in that. You know, the women wear these guys down at some point. You know, I was very disappointed with my father when he sort of became very openly affiliated with the Catholic Church. I mean, he would go to church on Sunday, but he didn't make any point of it, you know, at all. But my mother was very involved with that, you know, coming from her own family background. Her family had been very devastated by alcoholism, her father and her brothers, and there were a lot of family secrets. One of her brothers was in a mental institution, and He had been a leftist, interestingly. But there was a lot of secrets that, you know, that that my grandmother was Jewish, that my mother's family was really, you know, completely almost wiped out by alcoholism, the males. I think all three brothers are alcoholic, and her father. And so there was a lot of shame, I think, and a lot of hiding. But my brothers and I bonded very closely. I think that, which is true to this day, you know, and I think it was sort of a kind of a survival mode that we realized that to get out of this alive, we had to stick close together. I don't know whether it came from that or there was a kind of general overall incompetency, I think, you know, going on. And my grandmother trying somehow to keep it together, you know, to find enough food to put on the table, to cook, to do something, you know. But it didn't work very well. We moved around 1945 into a four-room apartment with heat, except the radiators were freezing. I mean, I grew up, there was ice on the inside of the windows throughout the whole winter. I mean, I've never seen that anywhere else.
Did your father's work and the conditions in which you were living have any effect that you can sense on his politics?
My father was very definitely class conscious and very pro-union. There was no question about it. And it was very evident, you know, that he believed in unions, and that was part of the family culture, but that was also almost universal where we lived. I mean, that was, you know, nothing unusual or uncommon, and that there was some definite idea that the Democratic Party was for the working people, for the poor. They wouldn't say poor, they say for the working people. I mean, we had no delusion that we were middle class at any point. I mean, that just would have been silly. We just weren't. I mean, you know, like we would say something like, well, where's the newspaper? It was on the Koch table. So I go, what's a Koch table? Well, Mrs. Koch gave us the table. So that became the Koch table, you know? I mean, like, it was like that type of situation. Some of it's a little hard to understand. I mean, my grandmother did some work. She always, like, she worked for a brother-in-law who had a delicatessen. Later, she became a candy lady in a movie. My mother started working when I was around 7 or 8, locally, in a, you know, different stores in the neighborhood. My father frequently was unemployed and couldn't find work. He would be like spaces in between work, and then he was on strike quite a lot. When he finally got a good job, which was in the Korean War, working for Wright's Aeronautical, there were very long extended strikes. It was UIW. Plant. But it was the first time he had health insurance, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and things did seem to get better. We were the last people on the block to have an icebox, that kind of thing. There was a lot of shame involved. I think they really wanted to, but some of it was very upsetting. I mean, like, you know, like we were sent to Catholic school, and they would have milk, which the government provided. But you had to buy the cookies. And some days there would be Malamars, and other days there would be oatmeal raisin cookies. And we never had the 2 cents for the cookies. So we would sit and watch the rest of the kids eat their Malamars and their cookies. There was a lot of shame involved, you know, of being that poor. And it never has left me, you know, to this day, and I don't think it can't ever, you know, nor my two brothers.
Did you stay in parochial school through high school?
Well, it got a little complicated. At some point, my mother took us out of Catholic school, and I looked back at it recently, and it didn't make any sense, given her, you know, affiliations and her devotion to the Catholic Church and so on. And so I asked my younger brother about it, and he said, well, that was because a nun had punched my older brother and gave him a black eye. So my mother had at least that much sense, that to prioritize her children's needs over her, you know, belief in the church. you know, her loyalty to the church. And we were sent to public school. But it was very difficult because it was an extraordinarily different culture. You know, at that time, this was like a very working class area, and the Catholic schools were very regimented and very crowded, by the way. And one thing they didn't notice is they didn't notice I couldn't see. My mother didn't notice it, and the school didn't notice it. So when I was transferred to the public school in the sixth grade, they noticed that I couldn't see. I could barely see the big E on the chart. And I got my first pair of glasses. But I was in that kind of type of limbo for years before that. My mother started to work a bit more, I think. And also, my grandmother got Social Security. That might have had something to do with it, come to think of it. And my father, I think, was probably still working in rights. And we moved in 1953 or so, to a better apartment in Weehawken Heights, which was a more middle-class town. Now, where we lived was not middle-class particularly at all. In fact, it wasn't. There were a lot of rooming houses, there was a bar on the corner, and so on. But it did mean there was a good public school system, and that was very important. I went to public school there in the sixth grade, and I was given an IQ test, and I came out like the second highest in the class. And that was not noticed before by anyone. You know, in the Catholic school, they would put us in rows according to what they thought were the smartest kids. And I was, out of the eight rows, I was in five, you know, one being the top. And, I mean, I just didn't fit into their idea of what they thought a smart kid was. I don't know how they decided that. But for the first time, I got some recognition that I was intelligent. And that was very good for me. That was very helpful to me, you know.
And what happened in high school? Where did you go to high school?
Well, I couldn't adjust well to the public school. I mean, again, it was a kind of a cultural problem. I didn't know the protocols, you know. There was a difficulty. A much larger part of my story is being gay than I realized. And I've only realized that recently. And, you know, how big that impacted at every point along the way. But in Catholic school, interestingly, that didn't become an issue because there was no physical education, for example. I never really did any kind of competitive sports. I mean, I could, you know, roller skate, I could bicycle ride, you know, I could even swim a little bit. But I couldn't do competitive sports, you know. But in Catholic school, that wasn't an issue because there wasn't any organized gym classes. There was a gym teacher that came once a week. You had to pay a dime. We didn't have the dime, by the way. And we sat on a bench watching this, for some of the time at least. But that wasn't an issue, really, about that. But in public school, there was gym every morning, actually. And that was torture for me. That was very difficult. You know, being picked last, and oh, God, that was a daily crucifixion. So I was happy to go back to Catholic school. That was in the seventh grade. But by that time, a kind of a seed had been planted, I think, maybe in the public school in part. I'm not entirely sure what, but I had said some shift had occurred. I mean, I still very much thought of myself as a Catholic. I don't think that could have been different at that moment. But I had always been a Dodger fan. I was the only Dodger fan on the block, you know. But at that time, the New York Post was very liberal. And one of the aspects of it being liberal is that it was pro-Dodger. Probably half the people who read the New York Post on that day were from Brooklyn, you know. So I started to read the New York Post because of James Cannon and because it was pro-Dodger. Well, I would read that, and all of a sudden I turned the page, and there was Max Lerner, there was Murray Kenton, there was this whole world, and I just fell right into it. I just fell right into it. I don't know, it was like an odd thing. You know, I don't know anyone else that read the Post. There were very few copies on the newsstands. There would have a couple where I grew up, you know. There were very few Jewish people in the area.
Well, it sounds like, despite what you say about a certain kind of defensiveness and insecurity and sort of social situations, you certainly had a kind of independence in other ways.
Well, yeah.
there was and self-confidence.
There was some strengths from somewhere. It's harder for me to identify where the strengths came from. There was a lot of neglect. I mean, I don't think they didn't monitor particularly what we did. We went off, you know, and that wasn't monitored, what we did in school, what we did outside. We were free agents. My younger brother worked full-time since he was 14. He worked in a bakery.
Now, you went back to Catholic school, seventh grade, but high school was...
Well, then when I went to high school, already in grammar school, I was becoming ideologically a dissenter. I became very anti-McCarthy. There were other kids in the class who were anti-McCarthy, by the way. I wasn't the only one. That was debated a lot. A lot of the kids, their fathers had been Coghlanites. So there were some ideas around. I mean, so at least there were some ideas, you know, of some sort to work off of or with. There was an undercurrent of Catholic social teaching. There was some undercurrent. I mean, the focus was not on getting ahead, either in my family or in the school. The focus was on something else. It's a little harder to identify, but it wasn't that it was preparing you for the great American middle class or success as conventionally defined. You know, so in a way, that could go off in a number of different directions. It might have been preparing some people to have a vocation, you know, to be a priest or a nun. That would have been ideal. But the idea was that what was prioritized was loyalty to the Catholic Church. It was very much an organization. It's very Irish Catholic, you know, very Jansenist, as it's called, you know, kind of a Catholic Calvinism. But a lot of devotion to the organization, to the church militant, as they called it, you know. And it was kind of ghettoized. It was, you know, kind of... affiliating with other people was very discouraged. You had, you know, Catholic Boy Scout troops, whatever. And when I was a kid, I remember people being married outside the church, outside the doors of the church, or even in one case, on the steps of the rectory of the church, because if there was a mixed marriage, then they couldn't enter the church to be married. So they would be standing outside the church for the ceremony. And, you know, it was that kind of a world, a very narrow world. But I think I was beginning to, from reading the Post in grammar school, I started to get a social conscience, and I was very disturbed by what was happening in the South, you know, the beginnings of the bus boycott and so on, and that really became very disturbing to me, you know, about what was happening in the South. And I viscerally hated McCarthy. I don't know. Almost overshadowed all other issues for me. That I saw him as a bully. And it was the worst kind of a nightmare, actually, for me, of a personality or type, you know. So I somehow, I think, seemed maybe to not fit in as much to that setting. But I had many good friends. Some of them, unfortunately, most of them have died. But, you know, I was always very successful socially. I always had a lot of friends. I put a lot of energy into it, you know, and had lots of friends and, you know, socialized a lot. And then I would read a lot, you know. I didn't pay too much attention to school at all.
Did you think about college at all when you were?
Well, college wasn't on the map. I mean, my parents didn't graduate from high school, and neither of my brothers graduated from high school. I mean, there was no message of getting ahead. The idea was, it was really there was another message. The message was not to be a bum. I mean, that was the message. You not to be a bum. That meant that you worked. You know, that it was a disgrace not to work. So there was a very strong work ethic, but it didn't matter what you did. It didn't matter what you did. You could do anything, pump gas, or there was like no differentiation between what kind of work you did. You could be a chef, or you could be a waitress, or you could be, but you had to work. And they showed no concern. I mean, neither parent showed any concern whatsoever about, our advancement. And I think they positively didn't want too much of that themselves. You know, whether they saw that had something to do with family solidarity or us not.
Did you get any encouragement in school to think about college when you were graduating?
Not particularly. No, I don't think so. A little bit. I think later I did in high school. Because I went to a Catholic high school, St. Michael's, and it was, again, very much a repetition of the Catholic school system that existed at that time in Hudson County, which was very primitive. I mean, you had lots of nuns and teachers who, I don't know what their qualifications might have been, and very large classes, and an extraordinarily old-fashioned type of curriculum. Lots of religion, tons of religion, and tons of religious observance. I mean, we were dragged off to church regularly. You know, it wasn't about Sunday. It was about, First Fridays and, oh God, all kinds of other occasions, all kinds of religious holidays and, oh my God, all the time. But for me, I started reading, I had started to read. And I read The Nation. It was pretty boring during that time. But I just sort of began to read. I don't know how it all happened. A lot of novels, Madame Bovary. I started to find a Russian novelist, Some of that took place a little more in college, but I started even then, Dostoevsky I started to read. I mean, I just went from one
to another. It's hard to imagine how you came across that stuff.
Exactly. I would go to the public library. I remember once as a kid during the summer, going back to West New York, I would go to the library during the summer with a girlfriend and little girlfriend. This is maybe when I was 11. And I was just looking for books to read, and I picked up Uncle Tom's Cabin. And that made an enormous impression on me. I can remember what the book looked like, the cover on the book. It was like an old book, It's hard for me to say where it came from. I think I gravitated toward smart people. I had an instinct to do that. There was a big culture of talking at the time, whether it was some part an Irish thing, maybe, because the predominant group was Irish. I mean, if you weren't Irish, they made you Irish in the Catholic Church at that time. That was the culture of the Catholic Church, was very Irish, and it did privilege talking a lot. I mean, there's a lot of talk, a lot of discussion, and arguments about religion or political issues, and we would stand on the street corner arguing about McCarthy or maybe more and more about the Catholic Church. There were some rumblings pretty early on. But the big break for me happened, curiously, I was expelled from the Catholic school. I became very rebellious, sort of just acting out, being hostile to the teachers and cutting classes, and I was expelled from the Catholic school. And then I went to a short stint back in a public school. Then I again went to Catholic school. This was Holy Family, and a smaller Catholic school. And there, there was an ideological outburst, a conflict, because I really was acting quite normally, I think, as I look back at it as a student. I showed I went to class on time, I did my homework, but they were getting uncomfortable with me, and I was getting perhaps more uncomfortable with them, but I wasn't that aware of that, actually, at the time. I remember in an economics class, they talked about the different political systems. We had economics once a week, and they described socialism. And I said, well, what's wrong with that? I mean, I don't think I said it open. I said, what the hell? So what's wrong with that? That sounds good to me. I remember thinking then that my father worked for Wright's Aeronautical. So they were producing airplanes that the government bought. So the government would give the money for the airplanes, but it meant they had to give the profit to the people that owned the factory. So I said to myself, then why? It didn't make any sense. Why then didn't the government own the factory? They wouldn't have to pay the profit for the air to the owners of the factory. And I don't know whether I thought my father would get some of that money. I don't know what. I remember earlier when he was on strike, it crossed my mind that the amount of money he should get was the most possible. I mean, I remember that crossed my mind, that that was the right amount of money, the most possible in that situation. My grandmother was sort of angry at the rich people. She'd call rich bitches. She'd call rich bitches. The rich bitches, she'd say all the time. That, you know, so there was something going on, you know. But then, to this day, it's surprised me. There was an anti-intellectualism in the Catholic school system that was pretty intense, and a fearfulness of individuality in any particular way. It was very, very regimented. And so I had bought a book. It was Elmer Rice. He had written a kind of a tract, more than a book, called But We Were Born Free. And this was an early, early tract. I've seen very little reference to it, maybe none since that I can think of. It might have disappeared in this sense. It was meant for a mass audience. Written from, you know, a Cold War liberal type of perspective, perhaps, but anti-McCarthy. It's one of the earliest books written, actually. And I bought that, and a nun came up to us, "What is that, Mr. Meyer? What's that book?" I said, "It's a book." She picked it up, and she looked at it. And she turned to the rest of the class and said, "Don't talk to him." And I don't know, maybe I had stayed up too late reading Dostoevsky, or I hadn't had enough cigarettes already. I threw my books across the floor and I walked out. Now, I'd always said I was expelled, but I wasn't. I walked out. I mean, every time I've told that story, I must have told that story 1,000 times in my life, 500 times, whatever, I always said I was expelled from the Holy. I wasn't expelled. I fucking walked out. That's better. Now, when I walked out, I went to the public school, which was Weehawken High School. Now, in Weehawken High School, they were more liberal, and they understood that they had this kid with problems, and they sent me to the guidance counselor, and I was already seeing a therapist. So the idea was, what bothered you? What bothered me was gym. Well, guess what? They said I didn't have to go to gym. This was incredible, you know. But something else happened too, is that there at Weehawken, there were a lot of these little working class towns, a couple vaguely middle class, but fundamentally these working class towns in Hudson County. And at that time, North Bergen, which was the most middle class of these towns, did not have a high school. And North Bergen had quite a large Jewish community at the time. And those kids went to Weehawken. They went to Weehawken High School. And that really made a shift in the high school in a very dramatic way. I mean, these were very good students. And they were kind of lower middle class. Some of them were working class, not many. Kind of lower middle class, some a little better than lower middle class, a couple from profession families. But they were serious students, and they were, for the time, remarkably left-wing and very pro-intellectual. So there was like this astounding shift that occurred, that all of a sudden I was thrown into a situation where I was at home, I think, and where what I was good at or who I was valued, you know. And that really, really made a lot of things possible. But while I was there, so also then I had, the teachers were good, because it was right across from Manhattan. So you had, oh, I don't know, maybe women from more middle-class backgrounds and so on that didn't want such a hard job in the city, and they came to teach there. There were gay guys that taught there, and we knew they were gay, interestingly. We didn't bother anybody. We sort of liked that a little bit. They were very, in the English department. But there were some very good teachers. There were teachers with PhDs. The wonderful building, the WPA Palace, gorgeous, gorgeous building, terrazzo, and magnificent gymnasium and an auditorium. And people were very supportive of me. There were many teachers, and I was good. I was good at history, especially. I was very good, and I won a prize. That was important for me. It meant a lot to me. And but I kept not being taking my studies very seriously. I started to read a lot more, you know, all the time. I was reading all the Russian novels and, oh my God, everything I could get my hands on. I was in class. There was a substitute teacher, and we were giving her a hard time, of course. And so she said, well, George Bernard Shaw, she goes, he was a socialist. She goes, not a communist, but a socialist. So I turned to my friend, Barry Aronowitz, and I said, Barry, I'm a socialist. So Barry turned to me and goes, I am too. And I said, what? I said, Barry, you're just saying that. He goes, no, in fact, my whole family are socialists. I go, really? He said, yeah. He goes, well, he meant they were labor Zionists. But these are the first socialists I ever met in my life. And I visited his home. I was, you know, we were friendly with a lot of people. And anyway, he belonged to this labor Zionist group, this Hecholot Tzatzayir. And I said, that sounds good. Because by that time, I had left the Catholic Church. And I realized when I went to Weehawken that something else very big happened. I went home and I thought about my grandmother. She lived with us. And I said, Grandma doesn't go to church. And when you talk about the Virgin Mary, she rolls her eyes. And she's talking this Germanic language with her sisters. And she's eating matzes and gefilte fish. And getting little bottles of Manischewitz wine on Jewish holidays. Grandma, what's your maiden name? Goldstein. Well, that was a very big moment for me. And I became furious at my parents. Furious. At my mother specifically. Also my father. That they did that to her. I mean, I just thought that was outrageous, you know. Now, maybe she wouldn't have said that anything anyway. Maybe she had never really, they had made some decision within the family not to do that. You know, the mother had been Jewish. Her mother had been Jewish. The father was Catholic. And there were three other sisters and two brothers. The two brothers never married, and only one of the four sisters married a Jew. So they probably didn't know what to do with it. They didn't know what to do with it, so they just, that was it. They didn't talk about it. I joined the NEACP when I was in high school. It didn't mean anything. It did mean something. I shouldn't say that. But I mean, I had nothing I could do with that. I remember I got a petition from them for integrated schools. And you know, I got something like 1,000 signatures on the petition. Almost everybody, this was in the McCarthy era, and almost every kid in the school would sign it. You know, I knew everybody, because what I did was hang out. I hung out and I read books, you know. And once in a while I'd go to class. So I did that, and I sent the petitions into the NEACP. Never got a thank you, never, I don't know what I expected, but it was just this isolated situation. I worked for Adlai Stevenson in 1956. You know, I just went to the local Volunteers for Stevenson, because the Democratic Party machine supported Eisenhower. And that was the only time Hudson County ever went Republican. I think in the history of Hudson County, of 150 years, 20 years, whatever the hell it is. And I joined the Volunteers for Stevenson, I passed out leaflets and put different, there's a name for them, but, you know, where you hang something on the doorknob, you know, the public housing projects and so on. I did that. But then the idea was I was going to go to Israel, you know. And so I went to this camp. They had called a Hakshirah, it was called, a kind of a boot camp, where you learned a little bit of Hebrew and some of these folk dances. And there, almost all the kids came from communist families, I think almost without exception. Two of them, their fathers had fought in the Spanish Civil War. And they were poor Jewish kids. I mean, they were just, you know, working class kids. And I fitted in with that. I liked that, you know. And then I graduated from high school. And I worked for 6 months in the New York Stock Exchange. And that was during the big steel strike. So every time the stock would go up, everybody would applaud. Every time the stock would go down, I would applaud. And there wasn't one African-American person working in the stock exchange. That was 1960. Not one. Not one single person. Not one person wasn't white. Whether they were runners or brokers or clerks or whatever capacity they were in. So I saved some money and I went to Israel. And I worked on a kibbutz for 6 months. And I think that was a great experience, you know. It was a wonderful experience. It was sort of like, you know, join the army, become a man type thing. You know, I had had quite a lot of trouble functioning, actually. And at least it's, when I think of it, maybe I didn't as much as I thought, but in the sense of showing up, you know, getting to school on time, being able to stay there for the whole day, you know, I had trouble with that. So when I was in the kibbutz, the first day I got there, they took some of us down to where the road was, and they gave me a pick. And so we were supposed to dig a trench, like a drainage trench, you know. And I remember swinging the pick, and it bounced off the ground. You know, and I swung it again, it bounced off the ground. And it was really hot, and I thought I was going to faint. And I didn't want to faint, so I sort of said, I have to go to the bathroom. I started to pray. I was praying to Jesus, actually. I'd been, Jesus Christ, blah, 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 blah. I didn't want to faint, you know. So anyway, so they somehow figured out this wasn't a good job for me, you know. So I started to work on in the Pardes, it was called, the orchards. And planting grapefruit trees on this sloping hill. And it was an exquisitely beautiful place. I can't tell you, this was in Emek Yisrael. And it was like paradise. I mean, and to me it was like paradise because I thought I was in socialism. I mean, as far as the eye could see, were all these kibbutzim. But they were like little medieval towns. Like they would have like a water tower. It looked like maybe a steeple of a cathedral or something. They all had wonderful, oh my God, I'm going to think of the name. I forget, Beit, whatever it was, a culture house. You know, I can't remember the Hebrew, Beit, whatever it was, the culture house, like a community center, you know. So, and then all these wonderful little houses together and lots of gardens and, you know, that was the first time I had heard a string quartet. It was in Israel. It was really a remarkably important experience for me, and that I was able to work. We would, as it got hotter, I arrived there in February, I believe, but as it got hotter, you know, it became more difficult to work, and there was questions about irrigation, and there was a drought. So the idea was to work earlier. So I would have to get up at 4 in the morning and work until 6 before eating anything. And then work more, and then eat, and then go to school. This was 6 days a week. Now, I was a kid that I couldn't get up. You know, I couldn't get out of bed to get... I would get out of bed to pee and then go back to bed. You know what I mean? And I really internalized a lot of self-discipline, and it was an incredible experience. I mean, to witness that, and a lot of it impressed me. We had been sent to dental clinics as kids, for example. So between my two brothers and myself, we might have one full set of teeth, but I wouldn't count on it. There might be a little less than that, but there's not more of the three of us together. Well, there the kids had braces. They had orthodontia. There was a dentist. That impressed me. They all went to high school. My two brothers hadn't graduated from high school. You know, I liked it. I liked it very much. I liked the communal aspect to it. You know.
But you knew you were going for a limited time.
Well, I actually deluded myself that I was going to stay. Now, I think that was not reasonable. I mean, in fact, you know, I think the way I was raised, you could never leave. You know, I think they broke our wings, you know, purposely. And I think that wasn't uncommon in those days. They wanted someone to take care of them, which we did. which we did. We wound up taking care of them throughout their old age. I mean, you know, financially, but also physically. We took care of them until they died. You know, and my mother was sick for a long time, 13 years, in their home. Never went to a nursing home. We took very good care of them. That's a very common pattern, by the way. I'm not saying they intentionally did that, but there was a payback for having children. You know, they didn't have children that they would be successful and go away or be very different than them. That wasn't the purpose. And nowadays people solve that problem another way. They don't have children. There was a kind of a group in between that wanted something else, but I don't know whether that works. But
so when did you come back?
I came back after 6 months, but I believed I was going to return. I actually was utterly convinced that this was a respite of some sort. I had not been accepted for the second level of the OLPON, which was the work-study program. And partly because I wasn't that clear. In an odd way, I wasn't willing to entirely declare myself being Jewish. I had been told that. They would say, just say you're Jewish. They told me that. Nobody cared. Nobody was asking about that. You know, the fact that I had a mixed background, they were all atheists, they were anti-religious, so the fact that the Jewish side was on my father's side was of no material interest to them. I mean, there were other mixed people there, too. But I somehow couldn't do it. It was an odd thing. Whether it would have been too much disloyalty to my mother, I really don't know. So I think it was a little bit hard for them to... It was going to the second level of the old pond was a big investment for the Jewish agency and so on, and they were concerned about immigration and so on, and they probably correctly sized it up that I wasn't going to come back. I wasn't going to stay probably. So the idea of I didn't know what I would have done. I mean, I would have had to work full time doing agricultural work. That's very, very hard. My Hebrew was. Halting. I was learning. I learned more than I realized, I think, at the time. Later, when I look back at it, I learned quite a bit. I can learn to read a language very rapidly, but I have great difficulties in speaking.
So what happened when you did come back to the States?
When I came back, my mother, who I think in a day-to-day way functioned poorly, did remarkably well in crisis. I mean, she could mobilize herself and be very focused and very effective. And within a couple of weeks, this was a repeated pattern in my family, she would go to the Jewish relatives. I remember my mother was the Irish Catholic one, and get money. And she would go to my grandmother's. She did it repeatedly when there was major illness in the family, around college, around taking care of my grandmother when she was dying. And she'd go to her sisters, my grandmother's sisters, my aunts, and my father's aunts, actually. And I considered them my aunts, so, and the brothers, get money from them. I said take money, because I think it was such. My mother did nothing reciprocal. Never acknowledged
it. And when you came back to the States, the purpose of getting this money was what?
Well, originally, I just got a job. Kind of part-time job. I had this notion I was going to study Hebrew more here, but I couldn't handle it. Because, remember, I wasn't going to go to school any longer there. I would have just worked. And I couldn't imagine how I could have done that work, which was very hard for me. It was hard physical work. The food was not entirely adequate at that time. I mean, I'd been accustomed to better food. And life there was really quite poor. And in that particular kibbutz was under average for various reasons in terms of the economy of that kibbutz. And I had gotten very sick when I was there, too. You know, I think it was just a question of nutrition, actually. And so I couldn't picture how I could have learned Hebrew on my own further while working that kind of work. And I couldn't, so I had the presence of mind to return. And my mother did send the money for me to come back. I had raised the money to go. And when I got home, I don't know whether she volunteered it. I think she did. And she borrowed money also. And I got money to go to college. And I went for a year at Fairleigh Dickinson. I had taken my college boards, and I got a perfect score in history, which is very unusual. I mean, that's, you know, in my high school, as far as I knew, I was the first person to get a perfect score in any of the tests. The tests were harder then, by the way. And so I'd gotten a perfect score, which I also repeated when I did the graduate records later. You know, it's kind of an unusual thing. But all that reading, you know, not going to class and reading, at least for a test like that, does pay you off a lot, you know. And but I went to Fairleigh Dickinson for the first year, and but I had, I think at that point, really, I self-identified myself as a communist. I think that I had, in somewhere when I was in Israel, I had made that decision that that's what I was. The people I met on the boat going, I met a girl who came from a communist family. And the people on the kibbutz that were from the pro-Soviet party, there were some people there from Mapam, which is still was very pro-Soviet. I gravitated toward them. And it was just my outlook. It was just the way I looked at things. And the Jews from Latin America were very left-wing, that were on the old part. And so when I came back, That was where I was going to be, I think, for the rest of my life. I mean, that's how the die was cast from that point on, it seemed to me. Because I did see I wasn't going to go back to Israel. And so I went to Fairleigh Dickinson, and I joined a carpool. And when I got into the carpool, there was someone else in the carpool, this fella's car. And that was the... a recent immigrant from Yugoslavia, and her name was Mara, and she couldn't speak English very well, and she had come to America from Yugoslavia around the same time that I had landed from Israel, and I thought I was going back, and she thought she was going to Israel, and she thought she was going back to Yugoslavia. Well, anyway, that's the woman I ultimately married and had children with. But we did have a lot in common because she had come from a family that was very left-wing. They'd been partisans and so on in her family, and people that, you know, were supportive of that and involved with that a lot. So we had a great deal in common. And but she wasn't Jewish. So the Jewish connection, in a way, had very little opportunity to persist, because Zionism, in a sense, which I had believed in a way, I mean, I think, at least that outlook, didn't see any future for Jewish life outside of Israel, and was really quite contemptuous of that. And I wasn't religious, I was an atheist, so, and now I was with a girl that wasn't Jewish, so that I didn't know what to do with that. You know, I might have been curiously, maybe the type of dilemma that my grandmother was in, so I didn't make too much of that, you know, after that, you know. Although culturally, I always have felt very Jewish, you know. And
so, what was your
most people assume I am, by the way.
In enrolling in Fairleigh Dickinson and going to college, what was your thinking about what you were going to do?
Well, I knew I've been very fortunate in one way, is that there's sort of like an arm sticking out from heaven, you know, pointing with a finger pointing, saying history. I mean, I never was very good in anything else. I was always very, very good in history, of getting the perfect score in the SAT, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, it wasn't that my other college boards were that remarkable. I mean, a couple of them were very good, but there was nothing very remarkable. I mean, that was what was remarkable about Jerry Meyer. There wasn't anything else that was that remarkable. So it seemed to me, I had the idea right away, which was quite an idea to have for somebody from my background, that I wanted to teach history in college. I didn't want to teach it in high school. I didn't want to at all. But that's what I wanted to do. And I felt I was good at it. And I started to get some very positive feedback right away at college, you know, in terms of teachers taking interest in me and so on. But what was very important was that I had internalized all of this. You know, everything after the kibbutz was a piece of cake, I'm telling you, up to this day. I mean, you know, I mean, nothing has matched, you know, what I had to do there, you know, for those 6 months. I mean, everything was a bit easier than that. So going to college and showing up and doing your homework and assignments and reading this thing and that thing, I mean, that was a piece of cake. And so I started to do well, and I started to do political work. I joined the committee to abolish UAC. And I went to New York, and I started to, to do various political activities. We would show Operation Abolition. There was some right-wing film, and then we had a contrary film, or we had literature to show how that was, they were lying, and so on. And we would follow that film around and distribute literature. And then it was sort of like these large assemblies. It was kind of an oddity of that people had forgotten about before the mass movement of the anti-war movement and so on. Like the left had these large assemblies, like in St. Nicholas Arena and Manhattan Center. There was kind of almost like a ritualistic aspect to it. And I would gather friends together to go there. There weren't many young people. And there would be speeches, and there'd be Pete Seeger, or there'd be Martha Schlama or something, you know. I liked all of that. And I started to read The Guardian. I started to read The Worker. And very much felt that that was going to be my life, to do political work. And, but I kind of freelanced a lot. I got Carl Braden and Frank Wilkinson, who were among the last people to go to jail. They might have been the last on contempt citations from UAC. They refused. They took the First Amendment. And I got them to speak at the campus. And that was... And the college tried to stop me. They called me in. The dean called me in. And I had suspected they might do that, and I had put an article about it in the student newspaper. So that was already published. That would have been a little embarrassing for them. And then they also, I also said, well, you know, I'll have to get in touch with the American Civil Liberties Union Academic Freedom Committee. I just made that up. And so they said, well, as long as you don't do any further publicity, young man, you know. But that was good for me to see that's what goes on in America, you know, in a college, you know. Shit, you know, what were we doing? We were having a public forum.
Did you graduate from Fairleigh Dickinson?
No. Thank God. I talked to a teacher, and I said, I really think I would rather go to Rutgers. And she said, well, if you want to go, go now. That was, and at first I thought it was very rough that she said that, but she was absolutely right. And I applied, and my grades were good at these, you know, sensational SATs, and they took me. And
so this was after your first year?
I went in my second year. And when I went to Rutgers, Newark, it was Rutgers, Newark, it was very much like a New Jersey version of City College. Remarkably so. It was less Jewish, but remarkably like that. You know, kind of working class kids, low middle class kids who were, you know, a lot of them leftish, and, you know, who couldn't afford to go away to school. So we were kind of angry about that, a lot of them. And in a very good school. It was a very good school. And we shared the same faculty with Rutgers, and it was, you know, a really good school at the time, very good library, but in a, you know, terrible physical plant. Chock-a-block buildings in downtown Newark. But when I went there, I went there with a political mission. You know, I wanted to form a club, a left-wing club. And that was, I had that idea to do that. And so when I went there, I didn't know anybody. Already it was a sophomore, people had already made friendships. So I went to the student lounge, and there were some people singing folk songs. I said, well, that's where I'm going to find people. That, you know, they were singing labor songs. And I remember one kid saying, Dennis, and Dennis would go, well, my grandmother said that Lenin, but I said, there's the first one. He was the first one. So it sort of went on like that. And there was a chapter of the NAACP, and I got involved in that. There was a chapter of CORE. And one by one, we sort of got together a very interesting group of people. Most of them had been from party families. And one of them was very funny. Shauna came up to me. Her parents had been in the party. And Shauna goes, I found another one of us. I go, really, Shauna? She goes, yeah. She goes, she's in the bathroom crying. I said, well, so what do you mean? What do you mean she's in the bathroom? She goes, well, she's crying that the history teacher said Robespierre is a terrorist, and she's crying that he's not a terrorist. He was a revolutionary. So, oh, that's the next one. So then we got, that was Carol. So one by one, and a lot of us are still friends. We all intermarried. It was really quite interesting. We were very tight. You know, a lot of intermarriage within that group. And we would do political activities. We'd do a lot of drinking at the time, a lot of, you know, hanging out. But we did a lot of things. I went on a little freedom ride to Delaware and Maryland with the Corps. We would go to the, we would have forums in the school. You know, we'd have a literature table, which would build for the public meeting, and then have a forum. It could be against the McCarran Act or about nuclear testing. We had one thing for gay rights, which I was opposed to. I thought that that was divisive and not political. This is all the time, pretending I wasn't gay to myself. I don't know who else believed it, but I was trying to believe that. But we did quite a lot, and we'd go to different demonstrations and do different little, very, very, very small scale, like a little picket line, or some of the marches against testing would be a little bit larger. But in a place like New Jersey, that would have meant maybe 100 people, 150 people. We organized, there was a CP-backed forum, this Friday night forum, and I would go there with my friend Carol, and the youth this year, they'd go, they'd make a big fuss over it. So we said, how can we get more people to come? How can we get young people to come? So they said, well, why don't you have something about Cuba, So we knew people, some of the young people had gone to Cuba to break the blockade. So the idea was to have a forum with some of those young people. And we would bring people from the college, and then there would be the people, the older people from the Saturday night forum. Well, we went there that Friday. The door was locked. The lights were out. Everything was closed. Well, what had happened, what we found out from the owner of the place, was, I'm a Mason, I believe in free speech, but the FBI were here. And they told me it's best if the place isn't open. I mean, the FBI was all over the place. I mean, I was not a member of the Communist Party. I was not a subscriber to the Daily Worker. I, was doing these activities. I would sell copies of National Guardian. I would get 10 every week or so. I'd get 10 copies a month review. I'd sell them. My father couldn't believe it. They would come to the house. He goes, I work on a lathe to send you to college. What are you, a paper boy? He couldn't, this guy did. But anyway, so we did a lot of activities, and it was very nice. I think it brought us closer together. So I think there was a lot of learning involved. I always tried to.
You say you had this very strong idea. You wanted to teach history in college.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened with this? I mean,
well, I didn't know what that meant. You know what I mean? I had no idea really what that meant. So I just sort of was taking it a step at a time or whatever. So I was a history major. So I took as many history courses as I could. And I did well. I would generally do well. But I also read outside the class. The classes were remarkably ideologically pointed. I mean, you'd go from class to class and they'd tell you why Marx was wrong. You know what I mean? The history classes, the economics classes, it was astounding, really. And I mean, that had the opposite effect on me. That made me want to know more. And I basically, I think every course, I would go to the library and I would get some left-wing book, that paralleled the curriculum of the class. It was pretty good, actually, when I think of it. But I did that. I really did that. The Russian history class was the worst. That was like listening to Radio Free Europe twice a week. So I remember I got a guy who was kind of Clarkson. He wasn't a Marxist. He was kind of a materialist, kind of economic determinist or materialist in some way. Kind of a very strange, interesting textbook.
Jesse Clarkson?
Yeah. And I read that along with the book. Or in the book on the Civil War, I got Du Bois's book on Black Reconstruction. But I did that in every course. I would find a left-wing book. I don't know if I always finished it. But I also would go to the library, I'd read different journals and so on, and the monthly review. I read the Social Democratic ones too, Dissent, which was a little more left than I suppose perhaps, I mean at least for the times, than later. New Politics I read. And I would try to do book reports on left-wing books, about Kautsky's book on communism in Central Europe during the Reformation, I mean things like that, So it's sort of training myself for something, I don't know what, but to be a leftist, I guess. But then when I graduated, I mean, I didn't know what to do. I mean, so I did what everyone else did at that time, which was to become a social worker for the Department of Welfare, you know. And I did. I liked that very much, by the way. I enjoyed it a lot. Was in the Bronx and going around and talking with people and sort of trying to work the system to maximize the benefit for the clients. And I did like it a lot. And I got involved with the union there, the social work union, to help build that, and joined the strike. It sort of was a little bit checkered because I went back to college to get my master's to avoid the draft, but I was getting more and more heavily involved politically all
you
the
went
time.
Back where, to Rutgers?
I went to City College for the master's program there. But I was getting more and more involved with more and more political work, I mean the union, but also mostly anti-war work. I think I took advantage of my ex-wife a lot, you know, to ignore her, not pay attention to her much. I remember telling her before we got married, I said, you know, the most important thing in my life is my politics. I can't believe I said that when I think of that. I don't know whether she responded. I said, but you have to understand that, I said. When I think of it, you know. I mean, it was really my mother. That was my mother, actually, saying
you,
it, because it was the most important
thing.
You
were married before you graduated from college?
We got married in 1965, right after I finished college. Yeah. I mean, people got married early. I mean, that was about the end of it. I mean, you know, if you didn't get married by then, you're not going to get married. I mean, people got married, right, you know, after high school or after college. The only way you can get out of your parents' house was to either go to the army or get married. You know, it would have been very unheard of. You know, you wouldn't have moved around the block. What would you have done? Lived in a furnished room? You couldn't live, people didn't live together, at least where I grew up at that point, you know, before they got married. So I really did lots and lots of political work all the time, to go to various functions I could see things were changing. I was very aware the FBI was aware of me. There was no question about it. And later I got my file, and they sure were. I got a lot of feedback, particularly from black students, that they'd been approached by the FBI or by a dean in the college, that it would be better for them not to associate with me, or they shouldn't be a member of the liberal club. Some of them approached me in a way of saying they were sorry, or one girl told me, a black girl, Gloria, that they had threatened to take her scholarship from her. That embittered me a lot, the fact that, you know, we had the way we had the meeting about Cuba. We hired a hall in an old hotel, and didn't tell them exactly what it was for. We had a lawyer waiting to go to a judge for an injunction. And at the last moment, there was the contract that I had signed for $45 became $450. We had to pay it. We paid it to have the meeting. But this was, you know, God bless America. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, I can't really forget any of that, you know. I felt very embittered about it. And it had the effect to make me more defiant, you know. I was generally very good at what I did. You know, I mean, I was able to get things done, get people together. I started to organize Marxist study circles. And I would get together friends, my brother, my older brother, people I knew, fellow students, and you know, sometimes it'd be 8 people, 12 people. I did it numbers of times. I studied the Communist Manifesto or Socialism, Utopian, and Scientific. Something was definitely beginning to change. I mean, you could see there was some change in the atmosphere, you know, starting. Although in the early 60s, it was still very much the McCarthy era, you know, very, very much so. You know, someone I knew in Newark was indicted under the Smith Act, I think it was 1963 or 64. I think they were the last people. But that went on to that point. You know, there was some pretty heavy-handed repression up to that point. What began to interest me more and more and more was the anti-war movement. I mean, I just was so drawn to it. I felt so... I don't know if I've ever felt anything as strongly as that, ever. You know, whether today it's gay rights or anything that I've ever felt so compelled about. But the idea that the United States was raining death and napalm on people, and a mass civilian population every day, and like... I mean, I was very motivated to try to help stop that, you know.
Did your politics at this point have any influence on your thinking about work, shifting from the you know, social welfare to
I would have been happy being a social worker. I might have stayed there. I thought in terms of my very good friend from Catholic grammar school, Jimmy Shanahan, was vice president of the union. You know, I had converted a lot of people in my life, you know, to Marxism and socialism, lots of people. I mean, it reminds me of my mother converting my father, but she did that with her friends at work to make them Catholics. I did that the other way, you know. And he became very devoted leftist, and a little less so before he died. He went more back to the Catholic Church. But he was but I had thought in terms of that I could work, you know, in the union. You know, I had some idea I would like to have done education work in a union, but I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know what that would be. I didn't know how to define that. I mean, how do you apply for that job or whatever? But I left really the social work job to go back to college, really to avoid the draft. Later I was called up for the draft, and I was prepared to go to jail, but I was able to evade that by, you know, saying I had experienced depression, which was true, and other different points about my somewhat troubled psychiatric history as a child. And I remember the psychiatrist, I was sent for an interview, the psychiatrist, and he said, "Well, you say you're depressive. Well, what depresses you?" I said, "This is very depressing." He says, "All right, get out of here. Because, you know, so..." But I felt bad because I'd been together there with kids I had graduated from. You know, we went back to the draft board where I'd grown up, and the kids that were there were the working class kids. And, you know, most of them went to Vietnam, many of them, clearly. And I'm sure, you know, many either died or were wounded. I did feel very bad about that, you know. But I was able to do my master's degree. I've done pretty well. I learned a lot at Rutgers. I don't know, academically I didn't do badly. I did certainly nothing very stunning, but I really had learned a lot. And I gained a lot of confidence because, you know, being able to form the club, you know, there was a kind of entrepreneurial aspect to that. I mean, there was opposition to it, you know. I was able to find an advisor, some old leftist, you know, somebody was going to retire, actually. And so he was willing to do that, I remember. You know, but to figure it out, you know, how to get speakers there and, you know, how to get to the room, how to, you know, it was very good for me in terms of my self-confidence and to bond with other people and... it was good. It was a very good experience. And I learned a lot. I really learned
so
a lot.
So once you got your master's from City, well, did you immediately go into teaching?
Yeah, well, in City College, I was studying European and Russian history, actually. And I wrote a very good master's thesis on Soviet agriculture. That's the connection to the kibbutz, you know, and the agricultural piece. And I did very well there, and I did get a lot of support from teachers, and a lot of, it was very, very good. It was a very, very good program at that time, wonderful program, wonderful degree, and I learned a great deal. And
despite people like Stanley Page?
Stanley Page liked me. Now, I don't know why, whether he liked, you know, I've somehow, I don't know how I finessed this in a way, but I think that... surviving, I think it might have something to do with being gay. You know, to survive in a tough neighborhood, you know, where I couldn't fight. I never knew how to fight. I could never throw a punch or anything. Never. I never did it my whole life. Well, somehow you have to survive. So you find some way of convincing other people not to hurt you, even though you're different than they are. I don't know what it is, but I charmed Stanley Page a lot. He seemed to think I was the cat's pajamas, even though I didn't hold back on my politics at all, you know. But he was friendly with me. He actually was the advisor for my master's thesis, which he told me was publishable, but didn't tell me how to get it published. He sort of like, you know, hang your clothes on the hickory and don't go near the water. But I did become friends with leftists there, you know, like Manny Chill and Walter Struve. And Walter Struve, I'm still very good friends with. He took especially good interest in me in the sense that he helped me with my writing, which was very chunky and very troubled because, I mean, I really grew up in a kind of almost illiterate household. I mean, you know, there was almost a dialectical English being spoken a lot of the time. I still, some of the prepositions I use are perfectly odd, and whether that comes from my grandmother, you know, or what was going on, but everything was double negatives, and, there was some paucity of language, too. So he really did help me a lot. He spent a lot of time with me, and curiously, I had met him before, and what we met was in the local anti-war, community anti-war group. So we had bonded there prior to being a teacher-student relationship. And in that group, we decided that the thing to do, because the idea was to build a community group. And it was all students and so on, and, you know, teacher types and so on. So what Walter and I decided was the only way we could do that would be to go door to door. So we were like Jehovah Witnesses every Saturday. Oh, God. We did this for like 3 months. And we developed a questionnaire. Are you for the war or against the war? If they said they were against the war, then we would try to get them to come to a meeting. You know, it never happened. And the couple of people that went to a meeting, when they got there was so much fighting, they never came back. I won't mention what leftist from what political persuasion caused all the fighting, but that taught me a lesson. There were people, this was a community group, the whole point was a community group, and there were people there from a political party, which I won't mention their name.
Why not?
It was the Socialist Worker Party, that insisted that what we were doing was wrong and that we should go back on the campuses and work. It was the most destructive, insane thing I've ever seen. At the end, they won. What they won is everyone else had left. But then, every single person. It was something out of... it was bizarre. It was utterly bizarre. But Walter and I would go door to door with this questionnaire. And then if they said they were for the war, we'd say, well, we understand. I'd go, now, but, you know, we're losing the war, so we have to escalate the war. Now, how would you agree? Would you like to escalate the war by using the atomic bomb? No. Raising taxes? No. Sending more troops? No. Oh, we said, okay. No, but we sort of went on like that. We would draw them into this manipulation. It was kind of very effective. There was only one person that kept saying yes. There was an Irish guy drinking beer. He was a bus driver. And his wife, I know, committed suicide. I wonder why. And he had like 8 children there. And he was popping beers. And yes, we should use the atomic bomb. They should take all my children and send them to fight and die. We have to stop. You know, oh, my, the kids are like looking like, ah, you know, us too, you know. My wife committed suicide, but the kids can fight. Oh, God, it was unbelievable. But anyway, this is how I met Walter. Then later in City College, and, you know, I kept doing, always doing political work, you know.
So you got your master's, what year was it?
That must have been like maybe 68. So I started working right away,
that was a time when there were a lot of jobs.
Oh, the jobs were everywhere. I mean, most of what happens to people in life is circumstantial. I mean, if you wanted to teach college history, there was no better moment in the history of the United States, the whole entire history of the United States with that moment. Everyone's going into college to avoid the draft. And then all of a sudden, all these programs, student aid programs and so on. And so I started to, and I, you know, I really I never liked school. Now, why I became a teacher is a curious question. But I always hated school. I hated being a student. I hated school. So I hated school. Absolutely hated it. I liked libraries a little bit, not much, but I was so sick and tired of school. And so I went for the master's program. Then we got to the doctoral program, but I couldn't stand it. So I went to the head of the doctoral. That was Adelman, no less. He was nice to me too. Anyway, so in any case, I said I can't take it anymore. I said I'm working full time. I'm doing this and that. Because I think I had gone back to work in the Department of Welfare. This all, whatever. So I said I really did this because I wanted to teach. And I can't be in school all the time. I need to make some money. He goes, well, there was a girl just here. I gave her a job and she turned it down. Would you like it? I said, I'll take it. That was teaching one course in Queensborough Community College. It took 27 hours commuting. I swear to God, from the Upper West Side to there. They paid $440. But that really started me off. And then I became like a full-time adjunct. I used to go from Queensboro to Kingsborough. I used to do everything on the subway. I practically used to have to urinate in between the trains as it was going passing the bridge. I would eat lunch on a train. I would never give my seat, no matter how crippled or old anybody was. I would do all my class preparation and all the correcting the papers on the train. And so I did that, but I treated the job as if it were a full-time job. And that really paid off because ultimately, when I finally got the degree, I think I was waiting to get to finish the dissertation, I suppose, whatever it was for the master's. I had, at the end, I had two or three jobs I could have had. Now, I took the job in Newark because they offered a three-year contract. This is for a kid with a master's. I think I had some doctoral work done, but not a lot. But that was the job market.
And you were doing the doctoral work at City or at the Grad Center?
At the Grad Center, yeah. I'd gone on to the Grad Center, still in European and Russian history. So at the Engineering College in Newark, they had a two-course European history requirement for all the students. So there was this clientele, forced into these classes. And boy, they didn't want to be there. They really didn't want to be there. But now the movement started to really get heavy. When I got involved, my God, to get four people together around anything left wing took a lot of work. All of a sudden, everything started moving in the other direction, and I was ready to go. So a lot of my friends had got from Rutgers, Newark, and people that had been in the Liberal Club and Carol and so on, very good close friends of mine, worked in the public school system in Newark. And I was sort of, and they were in the leadership of the Newark Teachers Union, which grew out of a remnant of a local that had been a communist-led local. And what survived were a handful of members that kept together to pay the salaries of the people that had been blacklisted. And by a miracle, they found, not necessarily a miracle, but by good fortune, they found black leadership that liked these old Jewish communists, and that include Lowenfels and so on. These were the people that Philip Roth writes about. They were his teachers, and they were remarkable people. They were people that rightly should have been teaching in college, but part of it was the Depression, and large part was because they were Jewish. They couldn't get those jobs. So it was a wonderful group, and what joined this, very aging and about to retire group of older Jewish leftist teachers who had been in or around the party was a remarkable group of black people that were very class conscious and very highly educated and motivated to do something important at the time. And they started to go for the leadership of the union. And I was involved with that. I was brought into that circle of people. Carol Graves was the president. And so I was brought into that. I got arrested. I went to jail and so on like that, from the outside. But I was doing that while in the college I was organizing a student peace group And ultimately, we did a student strike, and we carried it out to the end. The faculty were amazed. They were amazed. They couldn't believe it. You know, but I lost my job. You know, when I look back at it, I don't know. I mean, I was not certainly paying attention to my degree. I don't know, maybe I would have lost a job anyway. I don't know. But I mean, but there's no question, though, that once the student strike happened and I had been arrested, I went to jail, there was no way of hiding that, that the chairman stopped saying hello to me. I mean, that was it. It was over, you know. But I had the 3-year contract. And I continued, you know, doing whatever I could. You know, I sort of knew. I knew it was all over. And by then, my wife was pregnant with my first child, Anna. And I said, oh, my God, holy shit, now what, you know. I didn't have my doctorate. I was finishing up my coursework for the doctorate. And no job. And so I was preparing to go back to be a social worker. That option was always there in those days. And they gave you a test. And I remember I got 98 out of 100. It was like a vocabulary test, actually. I got, you know. So your priority on the list depended on your score on the test. So taking the test meant I would, you know, within 3 weeks, or because I had experience, I would, you know, I'd be back in there so I could support the family. And it didn't seem like a miserable idea to me. Again, once again, I thought, well, I'll get active in the union, and you know, I never conceived of moving outside the city. My brothers never moved. You know, the idea of removing myself from family and familiar backgrounds, even physical backgrounds, would be unimaginable for me, actually. And I had. During the strikes in Newark, there were a couple of successive strikes, and I did various kinds of support work and so on. There was a reporter from the National Guardian who was writing articles on the strike, and I sort of buddied with him to get him access to people and to interpret what was going on and to encourage those articles. And that he got a job at Osos Community College. The college started in 1970, and he was brought on board in 1971.
And what was his name?
Peter Roman. And then in 1972, when I got fired, he said I should apply for a job at Osos Community College. And I was accepted. And for me, that was...
And technically, at this time, you were still involved in the doctoral program?
Yes, yeah. Yes. I had basically just about finished my coursework, but I had not begun. I had not, in fact, completed my orals, and I certainly had not begun my doctorate. But that was not unusual at that time at all. The open enrollment had begun, so you had whole colleges opening up. And at that time, I had friends who told me, well, if I had to teach in a place like that, I'd rather not teach at all. And guess what happened to them? They never did teach at all, by the way, the people who said that. But for me, to go to Osos Community College was like a dream come true. I mean, from my perspective, there never was a better match, you know, in my life for almost anything that happened to me.
Do you say this retrospectively, or you felt that way?
I knew it from the day. I knew it from the first day. It was like a miracle to me. I mean, it was like everything that I was useful in that situation, and was honored, and was valued.
By the students, by your colleagues?
By everyone, it seemed to me. By administrators. I think I did better with the administrators than the faculty at the college, frankly. I wasn't prepared to join the administration, but I think I had less conflict over the years with administration than I did with my peers. I think that I think there's kind of interesting reasons for that. I think that one point being that I always had a more institutional view of the college, and the faculty always have a departmental view or a professional view, and I didn't have that. I mean, I really I just didn't have that feeling about it. I mean, my concern was to the institution, and the feudal arrangements always were reprehensible to me, and I had trouble adjusting to that. I mean, I think I've gotten a lot of support from faculty, in the Senate elections, the at-large delegates, I would always be first, second, or third. And they knew my politics. That was clear. I mean, I never explicitly stated that. I never said to anybody on the member.
So, did you become active, politically active, on the Ostos campus as soon as you got there?
When I stepped my foot crossed the threshold, I did. Within 2 weeks, I organized a forum on the presidential elections, 1972, and we had a representative from the Communist Party speaking there. Now, the college was, utterly unique. I mean, in the sense that we had a club of the Federation of Puerto Rican Socialist Students, for example, right from the very beginning. There were an extraordinarily politicized, radicalized atmosphere everywhere. When I got there, it was inconceivable that somebody would state that they were against independence from Puerto Rico, for example. I don't think anyone would venture to have said that. That would have been really absolutely unacceptable. To people. It was a very, very radicalized atmosphere. We got Angela Davis to speak.
Is it your sense that faculty were recruited with a notion of social political commitment?
Yeah, there was no... I don't know if it was... In my case, it was an absolute plus. I mean, my background was considered to be an advantage. The fact that I had been involved with student activities, that I was active in the unions, my ideological point of view was considered to be an advantage in terms of my application. Now, when I was interviewed, I was interviewed by a committee of faculty and students, and I was accepted over other candidates, including non-white candidates, for example. I mean, they really wanted me. That wasn't bad, That was quite nice. And it was a brand new college. It was so exciting. Newark College of Engineering, this dean, who imagined he was some kind of leftist, he would give kind of duties to everybody every year. So, one year I got making sure there were blue books in the filing cabinet. The next year I could take care of the bulletin board. I mean, it was like he treated us like we were children. It wasn't just me. That's how he treated the faculty of his department. But my foot crossed the threshold. I was put on the curriculum committee of the college and helped shape the curriculum of the college. I mean, it was a wonderful learning opportunity. And it was wide open. I mean, no one ever objected to anyone taking an initiative. And I think we had a president who was a kind of problematical guy, Candido de Leon. I got along well with him, but he had been a long time in a Franciscan seminary, and he wore sandals, and he was a bit different. And not very effective, but there was a lot that I identified with him. I mean, he really wanted the college to have a strong liberal arts background, and we had that. We very often didn't know what to do with all of this, but there was a language required. Most of this has just been jettisoned, by the way, 2 years ago. It's one of the reasons I think it's the reason I resigned, by the way, why I retired, when the shift took place in the college curriculum to a more conventional approach. But the idea was that a bilingual college, that was poorly defined, but also there was a very large liberal arts base in terms of the requirements of the students, 12 credits of behavioral social sciences, and a 6-credit language requirement. It's very rare, extremely rare, in a community college setting. I liked him a lot, and I liked the dean of faculty. I immediately worked with an initiative which melded language with discipline, you know, to help the students pass their the CUNY writing exam. And that stuck with me throughout, you know, all my years at Osters, to work on all kinds of initiatives having to do with the question of language and content. And I liked that a lot. And but it was wonderful in the sense that it was so open, you know, and it was extremely politicized culture.
But there were certain offhand remarks you made earlier that suggested there were also tremendous tensions or conflicts within the faculty.
Well, I think at the very beginning, that wasn't that detectable. I think, you know, it was a question of getting the school off the ground and getting it running. And I wasn't, you know, I was also just, you know, had crossed the threshold. But I didn't initially sense any particular resistance or rejection of me from any area, and a great welcoming. I mean, I don't know if I've ever experienced anything quite like that. It was very, I felt very endorsed, you know, very affirmed by what was going on. And I did try very hard. I really did. I worked very, very hard there, you know. And but I had lost my job. I knew a college of engineering. And I was aware of that, that that could happen. And I saw, I consciously focused a lot on working with the union. That it seemed to me.
Now remind me, mm-hmm. in at that time, 71, when
I was there, 72. Right.
Was the time to tenure still 3 years?
5 years.
It was already five years.
5 years, yeah. And so I knew I had been fired once, so it could happen again. And that was clear. And I wasn't going to change anything about what I did. You know, there was a leftist in the Newark Teachers Union that could have gotten me a job in Essex Community College. He goes, but you know, when you come here, you don't do the same things you did at Newark College. So I didn't say fuck you, but I didn't go there. You know, I wasn't going to do that. I think I saw my work as a college teacher as part of my political work. You know, it wasn't just teaching in the classrooms, although I saw to some extent, my teaching in the classrooms as a type of political work too, clearly. But it had something to do also with the activities outside the classroom to help build a community and a community of a type of resistance. I think that's how I saw it.
Were you tempted to move from the West Side to the South Bronx?
I had moved at that point already to Park Slope. And no, I don't think so. I mean, we didn't live very well. You know, we lived in a, you know, it was a small six-room apartment, but small. And there was nothing. My wife didn't work, you know. We had another child when I was there, Adam, in 1972. So I was supporting a family, you know. The salary was low. I got that's like $1,050 a month, you know. I bought a house with another couple in Park Slope, so the rent was very low where we were. But still, you know, there was nothing. There was, you know, we didn't go on vacations. There was no car. There was, you know, it was pretty, you know, pretty austere. Austere, or almost austere, you know. So I didn't feel, in that sense, any need to get that close to it, you know. I mean, I think that was good in a way because I knew there were differences. You know, I knew there were differences. And I think that was better. I mean, I wasn't them, exactly. And I think that was good. I didn't make that mistake in my mind. You know, I have boundary problems galore. But I didn't really have that idea. I mean, I had the feeling that I had had my own life and my own background, but I had a type of confidence, too, that I had something to offer.
Now, you said given what you recognize from your experience at the Newark College of Engineering was the insecurity of these college jobs, you had said, and I interrupted you, that you had connected to the union, right?
Yes, because I felt that if I were going to continue my political activities, which I certainly had every intention of doing, that that it would be better if I had some protection. And that so when that occurred, there would be some recourse. And there had been none whatsoever at Newark College of Engineering. There was no recourse at all. There was no union. There was no appeal to anything or anybody. When the dean called me in, I just said, you know, why don't you keep this short? I told him, he started, well, we noticed this. I said, well, let's keep it short, you know. Thank you very much. I shook his hand, and I walked out. I mean, there was nothing you could do. You know, what was I going to do? Go to the American Civil Liberties Union? Where would I go? It was just impossible. You know, you couldn't connect the dots.
Now, when you came to Ostos, was there an active chapter?
The chapter had just begun. And it was not terrifically active. And it was widely known as the White Caucus. There was a Black Caucus, a Puerto Rican Caucus, and the PSC chapter. I think the PSC chapter still at that year was still the United Confederation of College Teachers. It merged the following year. It was known as the White Caucus, and there were a couple of non-white people that would attend the meetings, but
it stopped.
Okay. I'm going to go.
Yes. Okay.